This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more.
Welcome to another edition of Layla Weighs In on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I thank you for joining me. I thank you for listening. I love that my podcast is pretty much up and running every Friday. And I really love hearing your questions, your comments, and any other ideas you may have in terms of health topics, nutrition topics, wellness topics. I like hearing all of them because you are giving me ideas on topics to talk about and your questions to answer. I want to talk about a couple of things today. There was a very interesting article I'm reading actually from Medscape, and it's something we already know, so I don't want to say duh, but here's the title: Vitamin B12 may slow brain aging. Really? Vitamin B12 may slow brain aging. Well, you know, when I look at my, when I look up deficiencies of B12, one of them is definitely dementia. So, and also neuropsychiatric disorders, that kind of thing. And now brain aging. They're talking specifically for Alzheimer's, but really the context that they're talking in is with regard to homocysteine. Now, for those of you who don't know what homocysteine is, it's a high homocysteine is actually a marker of, you know, not methylating well enough, not detoxing well enough, and homocysteine is a byproduct of that. Homocysteine is supposed to convert back to methionine, but it can't convert back to the amino acid methionine without adequate amounts of B6, folate, and, you guessed it, B12. We need all of those B vitamins for homocysteine to come down. What they found, a comment that they make here, is that B12 and total homocysteine might be independent predictors of markers of brain aging in elderly individuals without dementia. Well, that's interesting. And that they add that if the association is actually causal, that supplementation with B vitamins may be effective for prevention of brain damage due to increased levels of homocysteine. So, adequately timed and, you know, powered randomized clinical trials, everybody's asking for, but, you know, more research is needed. And I think that's how so many of these research scientists keep themselves, you know, getting the grant money to do their particular research. Now, we know that a high homocysteine is an independent risk factor, not just for dementia, and brain aging is now telling us. If you ask me, that's just another way of saying dementia anyhow. But it's also, a high homocysteine is also a risk factor for fracture because it is related to low bone mineral density, which, you know, indirectly makes me think about those important B vitamins are maybe aiding in our bone health as well, you know. And a high homocysteine is an independent risk factor for stroke, as well as cardiovascular disease. And I have to say to you, as an aside, I have seen enough high homocysteine with regular or even low cholesterol levels. And alas, we see that the person, the patient, the client has coronary artery disease. But their cholesterol is normal or even low with even a nice high HDL. But guess what? The cardiologist, the doctor, the internist, didn't take a look at homocysteine. Well, some years ago, I had a client who was concerned about her bone health. And I sent her back to her doctor, and she was seeing particularly a cardiologist at the time, for a request to check her homocysteine levels, among other things that I like to look at, such as cortisol levels, of course, magnesium, vitamin D, you know, all of the above that we know are critical for bone health. Well, the next time the client came back to see me, the homocysteine was not done. And when I inquired, the cardiologist said, well, there's not enough scientific research to support that a high homocysteine means anything at all. Well, I sent her a whole bunch, a whole slew of citations for her to look at. Now she's testing more for homocysteine. But I have to say I'm quite troubled that not enough cardiologists are looking at homocysteine, and this is an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease. But now I'm talking today about dementia. We're seeing more and more dementia. Is it because people have high homocysteine? Probably. But how are people more prone to a higher homocysteine? It could be that they're not getting enough B vitamins. How are we not getting enough B vitamins? A poor diet? Or we're living a diet and a lifestyle in a way to destroy our nutrition, our B vitamins. We know that sugar does this. We know that certain medications deplete our B vitamin stores, definitely oral contraceptives, birth control pills, and definitely medications such as metformin, to name just one. Also, B12 is absolutely needed in both phase one and phase two detoxification in the liver. We know that in phase one, we need most of the B vitamins, and we need flavonoids, we need glutathione, and in phase two detoxification, we need B vitamins again, but we also need amino acids, we need vitamin C, we need magnesium, we need choline and glutamine and glutathione. So they want to look further at this relationship. These were scientists at the Alzheimer's Research Aging Research Center, the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. So this is where the research was done. But, you know, I would think that it was common knowledge that B12 and homocysteine are related to some degree. Anytime I've seen a high homocysteine in an individual, when I look at their B12 levels, I see that they're quite low. And when I say low, I'm not talking about less than the 200, which is written there on your laboratory reference ranges. I'm talking about an insufficient B12 level that here, at least in the Hoffman Center or for other practitioners in the know, we want to see a B12 level of at least 600. We need a good 600 to help support our energy levels, to help bring down homocysteine if it's high. And often this is what we find. There is an inverse relationship between the levels of B12 as well as folate and homocysteine. We find that homocysteine is high when these B vitamin levels are low. So it's always critical to examine that. And by the way, if you are at risk for coronary artery disease or stroke and your cholesterol has been checked and all of that, you need to insist that your doctor also check your homocysteine levels. Now, this is very important. What's a good reference range for homocysteine? Well, the level goes as high as 14 or 15, being in the range of normal. But guess what? That's the upper end of normal. I know Dr. Hoffman likes to see homocysteine levels less than 9. So really optimally, an optimal homocysteine would be around 7 or 8, if not even a little lower. That's really what we like to see. Now, what are the other deficiency symptoms of B12? Paresthesias, meaning tingling, numbness, all right, particularly extremities in the limbs, in the fingers, in the toes, hands, feet, all of them. A sense of position, an unsteady position. Ataxia, meaning a loss of balance. Visual changes can occur with low B12. Neuropsychiatric disorders, confusion can occur with B12 deficiency. A sip of water there, thank you. And of course, dementia. And a B12 deficiency also I'm shown in my miniature PDR is a high homocysteine, a high methylmalonic acid. Methylmalonic acid is another marker for low B12. Your methylmalonic acid marker will be high if you have a low B12 level. All right. So who is at risk for a B12 deficiency? People who overconsume alcohol, okay? People with achloridia or atrophic gastritis, people who don't have enough stomach acid, people who have had a bowel resection or an ileal resection, people with pancreatic insufficiency or small bowel disease, those who have Crohn's, people with chronic diarrhea will have a B12 deficiency, taking anti-ulcer drugs, pardon me, medications, those who have H. pylori and the gastritis associated with H. pylori will have a lower B12. And anybody on a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet, but more likely a vegan diet, because vegans are not getting any supplemental B12 at all, because B12 is really found in animal products. Vegetarians will get some B12, maybe from their eggs, if they're pêché vegetarians, from their fish. And B12 is also recycled. It's recycled. It can be recycled for years in the body, and often we're not aware of a deficiency until many, many, many years later of being a vegan or a vegetarian. So have your homocysteine levels checked. We need B12 in phase one, phase two detoxification. Also, we need enough intrinsic factor to absorb B12. Who's going to be low in intrinsic factor? The elderly. And this is often where we find a B12 deficiency. Plus, they're not eating enough calories anymore. That's another thing. And they're probably not getting adequate amounts of animal protein. So it's times two for the elderly. The intrinsic factor is lower in the elderly, thereby not absorbing enough B12. And their homocysteine will be higher as a result, putting them more at risk for stroke. It's not necessarily a younger person who's going to have stroke. It's going to be an elderly person. And a lot of that has to do with the high homocysteine. On to another topic. And this is about vinegar and diabetes. Did you know that vinegar can help blunt the blood sugar response? And this, therefore, can make it beneficial for those with type 2 diabetes. Vinegar has been used for ages as a folk remedy for various conditions, including high blood pressure, leg cramps, weight loss, cancer prevention, jellyfish stings, and warts. Okay? And the research to support the use of vinegar to help lower blood sugar actually dates back to 1988. When Japanese researchers showed that vinegar, containing about 5% acetic acid, reduced insulin response in healthy volunteers. Now, a 5% acetic acid is generally found in your white vinegar. Your balsamic vinegar may have a lower acetic acid, like 4%, or even as high as 7% in other vinegars, such as white wine vinegar, red wine vinegar, malt vinegar. But malt vinegar, you know, is a source of gluten, so we'd want to be careful there for those who are gluten sensitive. So they found that in study participants who ate lettuce salads with white vinegar at 5% acetic acid as a salad dressing ingredient, they showed a reduced glycemic response in response to eating white bread. So that was very, very interesting. I've even heard people counseled on, well, I just ate a very carb-heavy meal and my blood sugar is high and what can we do about it? Eat some vinegar. Have some vinegar in a salad, not eat some vinegar, okay? And most of the research on vinegar for hypoglycemic effects has focused primarily on type 2 diabetes and prediabetes. Prediabetes, you know, meaning insulin resistance. And there were several small studies that involved a small sample of patients, up to 16 patients, have really shown mixed results of the effects of vinegar on glucose in patients with insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. So the vinegar appears to lower postprandial glucose, meaning it appears to lower the glucose that the higher glucose that might happen after eating following a high glycemic but not a low glycemic meal. So if you're eating a moderate to a low carb meal, the vinegar is not going to help anything, but the vinegar doesn't have to help anything because you're not getting a high, you wouldn't get a higher glucose response from a moderate to a low carbohydrate meal. So that makes sense, doesn't it? What you want to do also is be careful about the amount of vinegar that you're taking. The research, the limited research that's available, is saying that the vinegar taken before a meal may lower blood glucose from 20 to 33%. And the response does depend on the type of glucose load, meaning you're going to see a more pronounced response with a high glycemic meal rather than a low glycemic meal, as I just said. And you're not going to see any response if you're taking vinegar also with a high glucose-containing beverage like a soda or something like that. Vinegar does not help in that regard if the sugar you're getting, if the carbohydrate you're getting, is from a beverage and not a meal. That was very interesting. What I was starting to say before is we have to be careful because a large amount of vinegar can be very irritating to the stomach. It may cause nausea. It can cause potassium losses, which are not good for your blood pressure, your muscle, your bone health. We need potassium. Okay? And potassium loss has been reported with long-term ingestion of 250 milliliters of vinegar per day. That's about 8 ounces of vinegar per day. I can't imagine anyone taking in that much vinegar. Please don't do it. Please don't use excess vinegar in your salads, because erosion of dental enamel has also been reported. So it's advised that we should limit our consumption to a maximum of 1 to 2 tablespoons of vinegar diluted in water about maybe once or twice a day. Okay? Also, drinking through a straw can increase palatability and reduce contact with teeth, thereby, you know, not wearing on your enamel so much. But the best way to consume your vinegar is, you know, with an olive oil-based salad dressing. With vinegar, you do want to be careful if you have candida or if you have eczema. I have heard 2 reports this week from patients who told me, you know, I took a little apple cider vinegar and some water. I heard it could be beneficial for digestion and it's alkalinizing in the body. Yes, that's what I said. Apple cider vinegar can be alkalinizing in the body, okay? But for these 2 individuals, it spurred their eczema. And anybody with candida, you know you want to stay away from vinegar. You want to dress your salad in an olive oil-based dressing, but instead you want to use fresh lemon, and fresh lime juice. These are wonderful in a salad dressing, particularly the fresh lime juice. You'd be very pleasantly surprised. So, you want to be careful with those conditions. If you have eczema, if you have candida, if you're prone to yeast infection, any of those things. Now, vinegar has another side benefit, especially taking apple cider vinegar or any type of vinegar. It's been shown in the scientific research to help suppress appetite. Vinegar has that effect, okay? Because it just kind of, it bashes hunger. It just does. It could be its acidity that helps to do that. It was found in some research that I've read that having a salad with a vinegar-based dressing before a meal actually reduces the amount of food that you would eat during that meal. So it can be helpful as an appetite suppressant. If you're choosing apple cider vinegar, that's probably one of the healthier vinegars to have because it's alkalinizing in the body. Again, don't have more than 1 to 2 tablespoons in a day, and long-term use of more than the 2 tablespoons a day is not going to be healthy because of potassium losses. And don't choose distilled vinegar if you're looking for apple cider vinegar. You want the murkiness. You want the organic, unfiltered vinegar. I like Bragg's. You've got all kinds of murkiness in there, the cobweb-looking things. That's the mother, which is comprised of the acetic acid bacteria and yeast, which can help to re-inoculate your gut with some healthy, beneficial flora. Again, those with candida, beware. Those without, you could probably benefit from something like vinegar. And benefit with vinegar in terms of lowering your glucose response after a higher carb meal. I want to thank you for joining me in another edition of Layla Weighs In here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.